It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we continue with the next installment of our six-part series on heroin from WPR News.
But first, another foodborne illness outbreak in Texas may be linked to the cyclospora cases affecting over 170 people in Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Illinois.
We'll see how these outbreaks are investigated. Our guest was a former senior advisor on produce safety to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Dr. Jim Gorney is Vice President of Food Safety and Technology for the Produce Marketing Association. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Rob, for having me on the show.
Well, tell us about cyclospora. What exactly is it?
Cyclospora is actually a parasite, and it's pretty endemic to the Central America, to tropical and subtropical region. Many people would know it as traveler's diarrhea.
Uh-huh. So there's nothing pleasant about that. And how sick do people get with it?
Well, you typically get stomach cramps, nausea, fatigue, that type of thing, and it's quite unpleasant. It typically will, you know, doesn't hurt people badly, but it still is very unpleasant and not a good thing to have.
Do cases like this break out more often in the summer months?
Yes and no. Actually, cyclospora is a fairly rare foodborne illness or waterborne illness in the United States, again, because it's typically found in tropical and subtropical environments. So you rarely see cases of cyclospora in the United States, to be honest with you, and certainly not the 206 or so that have been reported as of today.
So how are we doing on identifying a cause for this most recent outbreak?
Well, as a former person at FDA, I can tell you that state officials and the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are obviously working very hard right now using a number of tools that are available to them. One is epidemiology. One is tracing the food back to its origin and then looking at samples to see if there's any contamination that can be found. And what I mean by epidemiology is they're actually going out and interviewing sick individuals, talking to their meal companions, people who ate with them, and asking them what they ate. And you can imagine that's a difficult job, one, tracking people down, and two, trying to get people to remember what they ate a number of weeks ago, which could have caused the illnesses. And, you know, I can't remember what I ate for dinner last night, so it's a difficult job.
You know, it seems like whenever we hear about cases like these, and sometimes, and this sounds like a milder version of some of the things that we sometimes see with foodborne illnesses, sometimes there are deaths involved, that people start looking at the huge business of our modern food industry and how, you know, one plant in California can feed the whole country. And in that case, you know, the advocates come out and say, well, if we just ate local, we wouldn't be having these problems. What's your response to that sort of conversation that comes up around this?
Well, I think foodborne illness and these bacteria and parasites, they really don't know boundaries. So they don't know if they're on a small farm or a large farm, whether they're in a big factory or a small factory that's producing food. I think it depends on what the practices are in that particular facility and in that particular farm. I've been all over the world. I've been to places like Guatemala and Mexico and other places, and I've been to production areas in California, and there's good farms and there's bad farms, and there's good producers and bad producers. And I don't think it knows geographic boundaries or enterprise size.
So you could get sick from that farmer's market cucumber just the same as you could from, you know, a cucumber in a bag from a big grocer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the issue is that our surveillance network, the public health officials who are looking for these illnesses, if someone does get sick from, for example, a farmer's market, very few people would get sick, and it would almost never be picked up in our surveillance network out there in public health, where, you know, typically if, you know, lots of people get sick, that's going to be picked up by our surveillance network of testing.
So how close do you think we are to figuring this out? Are there ever cases where we never find out where the source of contamination is?
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes they do lead to dead ends. So I'm sure FDA and the state officials are working very hard right now to identify that potential food source. And again, they're interviewing people. They'll be doing some statistics to try and figure out what the likely food source is. They'll be taking food samples out of ill individuals' refrigerators and testing those. They'll also be trying to link them, you know, those NCIS-type tools that you see on TV with genetic fingerprints. They'll also be using those to see if these illnesses that have recently popped up in Wisconsin are related to the outbreak in Nebraska and Texas and throughout the Midwestern United States. So they're using all those tools, but unfortunately, unlike NCIS, they take time. They don't happen within an hour.
Yeah, we were talking about just that angle at our editorial meeting this morning about how you go about tracing things back. And I guess one question we have is there such a thing as a food fingerprint?
You know, not yet, but certainly we're getting there. Certainly some of these labels that you see on foods, the universal product codes called UPCs and others, typically, you know, on some of those, you'd be able to go all the way back to the field for some systems. Unfortunately, they're not universal per se. But we are moving towards that, where you'll be able to pick up an item in your grocery store, and there are systems that are available today where you can actually see which farm it was produced on.
So it seems as though every year there are several stories like this, and sometimes it's cyclospora, sometimes it's something that's more severe that actually causes deaths. And when it happens like that, you get a lot of fear around food and people being, you know, a little afraid about the food they're eating and where it's sourced. And you've been really close to this for a lot of years. How safe do you feel about eating the food that's on shelves?
I think our food supply in the United States is very, very, very safe. The issue is that we consume billions and billions of servings every day. And, you know, certainly a small handful are potentially contaminated. But there's a number of things consumers can do to really help themselves. And it's a really simple message. It's clean, cook, chill, and separate. So what I mean by that is, with regard to clean, make sure your hands are clean. Make sure that food contact surfaces in your kitchen are clean. With regard to cook, make sure you're cooking foods to proper temperatures, for example, beef to 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Chill, and I think that's important this time of year to refrigerate things promptly, because it's so warm and we're experiencing these heat waves, that you get things in the refrigerator so bacteria can't grow on your food, and separate. Make sure that you're using a separate cutting board, and make sure you separate produce items from raw meat products, for example, when you go to the grocery store. So cook, clean, chill, and separate are really the key.
And if we do that, we can say we're reasonably protected. It's safe to eat what we eat.
Well, I think it's what consumers can do. I think that's the important part, because consumers really have to rely on everybody in the food chain with regard to that they've done their proper job in making sure that the food that they're purchasing and consuming is safe. And consumers need to take it to the last step. They have some responsibilities, too, and that's, again, cook, clean, chill, and separate. So that's really important, so they don't hurt themselves or their families.
And what about food producers? Are they being told to step it out at all, or is what we're seeing just sort of par for the course?
Absolutely. I think certainly none of these producers want to see their consumers injured. That's just a very poor business strategy, and it's not a good idea. Secondly, there is the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was passed by Congress in 2011, and there are new proposed rules from the Food and Drug Administration relating to produce safety, relating to manufacturing of foods, and relating to the import of foods. So the bar is being raised, and also industry takes it very seriously, because ill consumers just are not a good business plan.
All right. So we've got some precautions there we can take, and hopefully they'll track this one down and we'll get an answer. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, and have a good weekend.
You too. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Gorney, Vice President of Food Safety and Technology for the Produce Marketing Association and former Senior Advisor on Produce Safety to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Coming up, we continue our WPR News series on heroin, today looking at the drug as a public health issue. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're continuing our heroin series today by taking a look at how the epidemic is being dealt with in our state's capital.
Most places are primarily dealing with heroin use as a criminal issue. In Madison and Dane County, there's also a heavy focus on heroin as it affects public health. As Shemaine Mills reports, a nonprofit is leading the effort.
It might seem odd that a group which helps prevent falls among the elderly is tackling heroin, but avoiding injury and preventable death is what the nonprofit group Safe Communities is all about. In the past, they've addressed pedestrian safety and suicide. A visual example of heroin's increasing impact on the public is something most don't associate with drug use: driving. Safe Communities Director Cheryl Wicke says it's a big issue.
People will shoot up. As soon as they get their heroin, they shoot up. They don't wait till they get home. And then they pass out in the car, crash in the car. And that's been a very visible sign of an increase in the problem.
A former heroin user agrees.
It's a very dangerous thing. With the amount of traffic that's on the road nowadays, it's extremely dangerous.
That's 34-year-old Kelly Graycheck. This summer, he was invited to talk to a Madison church group, sending chills down spines with his personal revelations.
My father was a drug dealer. My father went to federal prison for 13 years. So I, at actually 5, 6 years old, I was raided by a SWAT team.
Authorities say Graycheck isn't necessarily the typical heroin user. Many are middle and upper class kids, says Julie Rortvedt. She's a Madison police detective. She holds community forums on heroin and has been disappointed with the low turnout. Rortvedt thinks families see it as an internal problem.
So what I'm finding is that they suffer in isolation, feeling like they're alone. They don't want to tell their other friends about what's going on because it's embarrassing. There's some stigma with it.
Yet Rortvedt says people seem increasingly willing to talk about heroin as it becomes more widespread, along with the diseases from shared needles. Graycheck, who served 7 months in prison for dealing heroin, nevertheless calls himself lucky because he didn't get an incurable disease from using.
You know, I got lucky. I am HIV negative and I don't have hepatitis C, but some other people don't get so lucky.
Part of Madison's approach is to prevent drug-related infection. Last year, Madison's health department gave out 28,000 sterile needles and syringes. Mary Jo Hussey coordinates the HIV program for Madison-Dane County Public Health.
It's on our website. We don't hide that we do it. And if you Google Needle Exchange in Dane County, our website pops up.
The AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin also distributes clean needles in Madison and around the state. Prevention Director Scott Stokes says since they started the program in 1995, there's been a 67% drop in HIV infections related to injection drug use.
So we know it's having a huge impact there.
Stokes says there's more hepatitis, so more work is required to control it. Hussey says needle exchange appears to be preventing its spread in Madison, but the practice has its critics.
It doesn't make sense to them, and I understand that. But I do think it's important to realize there's absolutely no evidence that this increases drug use or encourages someone to start using drugs.
She points out both AIDS and hepatitis are lifelong infections that are expensive for the community to treat. Needle exchange is a recommended intervention of the Centers for Disease Control. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Shemaine for the latest installment on the WPR News series on heroin in Wisconsin.
And here with us now to talk further about the public health approach is Cheryl Witke, Executive Director of Safe Communities. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you focus on public health issues. How does heroin fall under that umbrella?
Well, it starts, as with all of these issues, and I think your report this week has really demonstrated the complexity of it. There's lots of different components. And the folks that you just talked to in your report about Dane County represent a lot of different perspectives and needs that need to be taken into account in addressing this.
And so when did Safe Communities decide to take this up?
Well, we noticed, actually, thanks to data from the Public Health Department, that prescription opiates and opiates in general had increased dramatically. It exceeds traffic crashes as our number one cause of injury death in Dane County. And so that was alarming, and we also had tremendous leadership from the City of Madison mayor and the county executive, the law enforcement community, the treatment community. Everybody sort of came together, the healthcare community, to recognize that this was a problem that needed a more coordinated solution. And since Safe Communities has worked in other areas, including suicide and traffic crashes, we have an infrastructure in place to coordinate those sorts of efforts.
Can you describe what that coordinated effort would look like for heroin?
Yeah, well, it starts, too, with the data, and what the data tells us is that actually prescription opiates are a gateway to heroin, and today the number of overdose deaths from the opiate pain relievers, such as Oxycontin and Percocet, those sorts of things, far surpass the number of deaths from heroin and cocaine combined. So part of it is sort of also shifting the focus a little bit to what is killing people, you know, or how are people starting with heroin, and so trying to look at sort of a supply and demand approach to this. So reducing the supply of prescription drugs and heroin in the community, and then reducing the demand through treatment and prevention sorts of efforts.
So how do you reduce the amount of prescription opiates out there? Do you lobby? Is that part of it?
It's really working with the healthcare community, and they're very active partners in this. We have a healthcare task force that's looking at how can we reduce the numbers of opiates that are out there, and how can we screen people for potential problems with addiction before these prescription opiates are prescribed. So actually, if you look at this nationwide, there's been a tremendous increase in the number of prescription opiates dispensed, and it tracks exactly with the numbers of overdose deaths and hospitalizations. And that's happened for some really good reasons, and that is that as a community, we're committed to treating pain, and we really don't want to stop doing that. But on the other hand, there's been a tremendous increase in the numbers of opiates, percentages of folks taking opiates. If you just look since 1997, for example, with oxycodone, there's been a 588% increase between 97 and 2005 in the numbers of opioid medications prescribed oxycodone. So just the fact that we have that many opiates in the community in people's medicine chests, and they're so easily accessible and so highly addictive, that's one of the reasons why we've seen this increase in both prescription drug misuse, and then as people can't get those anymore, turning to heroin sort of situation.
Well, it's easy to see that if someone with a tendency toward addiction has this in their medicine cabinet from their doctor, they have a higher chance of developing a substance abuse problem. But why do you think there are so many more of these prescriptions being written?
Well, as I said, because it was a very legitimate response to what some people felt was the medical community's sort of inadequate response to dealing with people's chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a movement among patients that was supported by the medical community to make sure that people who were in chronic pain were getting the treatment that they needed. And, you know, it's been, I think, sort of a pendulum swing. Some people would say that there was a time when they were under-treating pain. Now people might be saying the pendulum has swung a bit too far the other direction, where there's a little bit too liberal of a dispensation of these very powerful medicines, and there needs to be more of a balanced approach to it. So part of what we're doing as a community coalition is educating clinicians. So November 1st in Madison, we'll have a training that will be one of only 10 in the nation. That's a scope of pain training for clinicians, and anybody who prescribes opiates is welcome to attend this, from dentists to primary care physicians, to have education on safe and competent prescribing of opiates. So that's one piece of what we're trying to do. And then the other piece, of course, is educating people in the community about the risks of opiates. There can be sort of a casual, well, I'll keep it around in case I need it, or my friend is having some pain, so I'll loan them my leftovers. That's a very dangerous practice. And so we're trying to get the word out that that's not something that folks should be doing, for both their personal safety and community safety. And then also we formed a parent addiction network, and we have wonderful resources that were pulled together by parents, treatment professionals, people in the criminal justice system to support families that are dealing with addiction. So that's parentaddictionnetwork.org. If folks would like to go on there and look at all of the different sort of resources that are available.
Well, so going back to safe communities, obviously you're approaching this from a different angle than law enforcement. What can public health initiatives like this do that law enforcement can't?
We really partner together with law enforcement, and I think that's been a beautiful thing about our partnership with all of the Dane County law enforcement agencies, is that they see that their role is one of law enforcement, of interdiction, and they're very willing to partner with other community organizations to address the other underlying issues. And there's a cool treatment law enforcement initiative that we're trying to launch here that really initiated in the Madison Police Department and with the Narcotics and Gang Task Force, where basically they're identifying folks through arrest who might want to get into treatment, and then they're making referrals directly to treatment. So that, I think, is a great model and an indication of the sorts of partnerships that are in place.
And Cheryl, we've only got about 15 seconds for your answer, but how is Wisconsin responding so far?
Well, I think, Wisconsin, we really started at the local level thanks to some leadership at the state level. And for folks who are interested in starting a local initiative like ours, I would recommend they look at a document called Reducing Wisconsin's Prescription Drug Abuse, a call to action that was put out by the state in January of 2012. And that gives a lot of tips to local governments, local coalitions like ours, on how to address this issue.
All right. Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking with Cheryl Witke, Executive Director of Safe Communities.
On Monday, we'll wrap up our heroin series by taking a look at drug courts. They're prosecuting cases while trying to be sensitive to addiction.
Also coming up on Monday on Central Time, we'll take a look at how technology is changing the workplace and what jobs are available.
And we'll discuss issues surrounding prisons in Wisconsin and the U.S. Throughout the week, starting on Monday.
That's coming Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, our guests will share their passion for peaches, growing them, eating them, and cooking with them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's just about high season for peaches. And I have to say, it's about one of the only foods you feel okay about when half of it ends up running down your face.
Yeah, peaches are a lot of fun. I've gotten some good ones lately. I've already done a little bit of peach cooking, and my wife did some freezing this season. And I'm looking forward to this hour a lot.
Right. I mean, peaches in Wisconsin in the winter, that's also a treat. If you can keep that summer flavor going as long as possible.
Well, our next guests grow organic peaches. A lot of people consider them some of the best peaches in the world. And they're with us to talk about the splendor of the peach. Joining us now, we have David Mas Masumoto and his daughter, Nakiko Masumoto. Together with their family, they run a family farm where they grow grapes and peaches. David's a columnist. He's won an award for food writing. Their new book is The Perfect Peach. David and Nakiko, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mas, tell me, do you remember the first time that you realized peaches were something special?
Oh, I was a little kid, and I remember eating it because we used to work all summer with peaches. And you'd think you'd get tired of them, but no, we didn't. And I remember when I was very young, maybe about 5 or 6, biting into one, and the juices squirted all over my mouth and dripped off my chin. And I was kind of fat as a little kid. And, you know, little kids back then wore white T-shirts, and I had these peach stains right on the round part of my tummy, but it was my badge of honor for the summer.
And you, I mean, a lot of people like peaches. You really love peaches, Mas. Why? What is so special about the peach?
I think I have this passion for peaches because they have this type of depth of flavor to them. I mean, and they're really unique. I sort of look at them almost like working with pieces of artwork where every peach is slightly different, every year is slightly different. So I'm trying to be that artist and farmer working nature to produce something that's perfect. And of course, you know, you never could get perfect, but that's the whole goal of the work that we try to do.
Nakiko, let's follow up from there. What makes for the close to perfect peach?
Oh, you want a peach that is as ripe as it possibly can be. In the Masumoto family, we have a word for the best peaches, and that's gusher. And these peaches are on the tree as long as possible. If they're yellow flesh peaches, they have an amber glow almost from the inside out. And they're heavy to the feel. And my favorite is to eat them at room temperature because the flavors just explode in your mouth.
Now, when I go to the grocery store, I look at peaches. I want to get them, but I'm scared because they might be rock hard and never really get ripe the right way. Or they might feel good, but then they're mealy when I take a bite out of them. I'm at the store. I'm at the market. Mas, how do I make sure I don't get burned?
Well, one thing is to start finding out a little bit more about the story behind those peaches. Everything from the variety, because there's literally dozens, if not hundreds, of varieties of peaches, and also where they came from, and hopefully ask the store who grew them. Because once you develop that relationship with that peach, I think you begin to differentiate peach varieties you like, peach varieties that are great for cooking with, peach varieties that are better for eating fresh, and also reward those farmers that are doing that little extra to produce a peach that's wonderful as opposed to a peach that sort of becomes more industrial.
When I'm buying apples, the store will label them all different: Red Delicious, Jonna Gold, you name it. Why doesn't Nikiko? Why doesn't the peach get that kind of love? It just says peaches at the store. Maybe it has the name of a state. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I just had the chance to follow our peaches to market up in Portland, Oregon, and I realized that every single box that we ship out is labeled with the variety and, of course, our address where it's from. And as far as I know, those boxes nationwide arrive to the grocery stores. So it's really a matter of talking to the produce workers in the market, because that information is literally in the building. It just doesn't always make it out to the sign.
Now, you both have really put your lives into growing great peaches. It's a labor of love, but I know sometimes it doesn't always work out. It's trial and error. Moss, what are some of the biggest pitfalls you've run into, or pits? Yeah, there you go. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've made in trying to grow the perfect peach?
Oh, everything from anticipating weather will be consistent. And I think you're going through a heat wave right now, are you not?
We are.
These are the type of things that you could do everything right, and right before harvest, suddenly that temperature spikes up and the trees get a mind of their own. Sometimes the warm weather increases, speeds up ripening, so you're out there picking. And, you know, we pick our peaches about 3 or 4 or 5 times, in a 2-week period in order to get them exactly ripe. But sometimes when it gets really hot, the peaches decide that, you know, I'm going to just kind of take a lot of siestas. And they slow down. And the next thing you know, you're out there slowly picking a little. Then you wait a couple days and slowly pick a little. And it's this constant, you could say, battle or dance with nature. And that's probably the biggest struggle that we have, because nature is wonderfully unpredictable, and at the same time we're begging it to be a little consistent so we could squeeze out something from nature.
Nikiko, Moss just said the peaches decide, and reading your books, I get a sense that your family relates to peaches as a living, full organism. Can you talk about that relationship with the trees and the peaches?
Yeah, the unique thing about our farm, I'm the fourth generation to work on this land. And so the peach trees have become my friends. They're living organisms that hold the stories of my great-grandparents who were immigrants from Japan. And we listen to them. We try to communicate with them. And we really, I find solace in the fields. And it's this wonderful experience for me as a young farmer, because I realize on the one hand how important what we're doing is, being organic, being a small farm, working together as a family. And then on the same turn in the orchards, I remember how small I am, that I'm just one piece of a much bigger universe, hopefully full of pleasurable food and good stories.
And we've spent some time talking about how you grow the peaches, and we could go on with that for a long time, but I don't want to overlook the big part of eating the peaches. Of course, you can just rinse them off and eat them as they are, but your book has a lot of great recipes in it. Moss, in general, can you talk about cooking with peaches and how versatile they can be?
Thing about cooking with peaches is sometimes it attracts good partners. And Marcy, or my wife, and Nikiko, they're the great cooks. And I'll let Nikiko handle this question, because I'm the type of perfect cook in that I help the cook clean up in the kitchen. So, Nikiko, you want to take this question?
Absolutely. Yeah. One of our favorite things about peaches is actually savory cooking. I think when people think about cooking with peaches, usually our memories are triggered of that great peach pie or peach cobbler, which we definitely gorge ourselves on with during the summer. But one of the fabulous things is there's this whole world of savory recipes. And so my mom and I, we work to make sure that that came through in the cookbook. And it's actually our biggest section, our savory recipes.
Now, I just recently made some chicken for tacos with pineapple in it. You've got a peach and pork taco. So peaches cooked into tacos. It makes sense to me because of the pineapple thing I do. Talk, Nikiko, about the peach tacos.
Oh, yes. That's one of my favorite recipes. I usually say that pork and peaches were meant for each other. The pork tacos are slow cooked. which is perfect for working women. And we usually pair that with a savory peach and nectarine salsa. And it's mouthwatering, and I love it.
We'll talk more about some peach recipes coming up. And by the way, those slow-cooked recipes are good for working men, too. I'm a huge slow-cooker fan, so I'm definitely going to try some kind of maybe chicken and peach tacos, pork and peach tacos coming up. We're talking to Mas Masumoto and his daughter, Nikiko Masumoto. They are peach farmers that grow the things. They love peaches. Their new book is The Perfect Peach.
And we want to know how you like to eat your peaches. What's your favorite peach recipe, and what is your most transcendent peach eating experience? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send your email to talk@wpr.org. We'd love to know if you love peaches as much as we do. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the perfect peach this hour and wanting to hear about your favorite way to prepare peaches as we come into the height of peach eating season. We'd love to hear about it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
On the line, we've got David Mas Masumoto and his daughter, Nikiko Masumoto. They run the Matsumoto Family Farm in California. They grow grapes and peaches. Their new book is The Perfect Peach. Mas, you said, you fessed up, you're not the main peach cook. What is the weirdest thing that your wife or daughter did with a peach that ended up working out okay?
Well, I know when they were developing the some of the recipes for this cookbook, Nikiko was working on, it was the Bellini recipe, wasn't it, Nikki?
Mm-hmm.
And so it so happened that it was on a work day, and it was like about 9 in the morning, and she decided to test like 8 different recipes for that. So there I was testing 8 Bellini recipes before I went out to drive tractor in the field. Needless to say, I was not very straight in my tractor driving that day.
All right. Well, and Nikiko, we've just posted a peach gazpacho recipe that you provided us with. Talk us through it. What's a peach gazpacho like?
The peach gazpacho is a wonderful, refreshing, cold soup. So you can serve it as an appetizer or even a palate cleanser. And it's probably one of the healthiest recipes in the cookbook. And it's also one of the easiest recipes. It's great to, you can make it as a family or with friends. It would be a great recipe to make with little kids. You essentially throw peaches, cucumber, a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of salt and pepper, a little bit of olive oil, and some garlic, and a little bit of cilantro, if you want, for garnish, into a blender, blend that up, put it in the refrigerator, and serve it ice cold, and it's great on a hot day.
Well, we could have used that today. Too bad it's cooling off here in Wisconsin. That would have been a great heat wave meal, or appetizer, at least. Any other recipes, Nikiko, that you were particularly proud of in putting together this cookbook?
Yeah, I would like to say my wild recipes was I came up with a recipe for panko fried peaches. And this recipe for me really speaks to my multiple cultural and racial lineages as a Hapa. Hapa is a term that generally speaking means mixed race Japanese American. And this recipe is basically, wedges, slices of fresh peach that are, dredged in flour, then egg, then panko, which is a Japanese breadcrumb, and then deep fried. And it's delicious. It's like a warm peach surprise inside a crunchy cocoon. And for me, it was a way of really tying together how food brings us and carries on our cultural traditions and who we are.
Well, and I'll tell you what, you found a way to deep batter fry something. It's going to be a big hit here in Wisconsin.
I could see alongside some deep-fried cheese curds.
Now, I wanted to talk about Wisconsin and growing peaches here in Wisconsin. Actually, I just found out our board operator, Michelle Good, has a peach tree that you bring it back in and out, right, Michelle? Yeah. And you've got a Wisconsin connection. The missing author here, your wife, Mas, is from Wisconsin. What kind of peaches can we grow in the state? What's some advice for a first-time peach grower here in the state?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges, and we've spent
many vacations in Wisconsin. You have this great summer growing season, but your winters could be a little tough on peaches. So you're going to have to make sure you plant them in a sheltered area where the temperatures don't get them too much, because peaches want to go into dormancy, but sometimes Wisconsin dormancy could be a little extreme for that. So it's got to be a more moderately sheltered area that you grow it. The other little challenge is peaches like heat. And I know you're having a heat wave now, which is sort of abnormal, because I remember spending some summers in Wisconsin. You have this wonderful, 80-degree warm day, a little rain, and then you go to the fryout after that. But the peaches like a little warmer weather, so you have to find that right spot for it. I think that's the main thing you would look for in Wisconsin for that. But certainly peaches would match a lot of the, as I said, the fryouts and some of the, peaches and brats would work great, I would think, getting ready for a Packer game or something like that.
We'll go to the phones now, and there's still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Call and tell us your favorite peach recipe, or if you've had success growing peaches here in Wisconsin, tell us what it took to make it work. 800-642-1234. We have Sue in Portage on the line now. Hi there, Sue.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, what have you got going with peaches?
Well, every summer I always make a peach pie that was handed down to my mom, and it's just your basic baked crust, and then you take as many fresh peaches as you want, you slice them up, and then the topping is several peaches that you smash up, and you cook it on the stove, and all you have to do is add cornstarch and a little bit of sugar and some lemon juice. And once that's thickened and it's cooled, you pour it over the top of the pie, and it's just like eating a fresh peach.
Yum.
It's very delicious, yes.
Thank you so much, Sue, for sharing that, getting hungry with all these recipes going out. Any ideas, Nikiko, for a twist on the peach pie? That one sounds great. I'm not knocking it, but anything to jazz it up and do something unexpected with it?
Oh, sure. That version sounds amazing. One of our favorite things is that there is so many different ways you can take peaches. You could grate or mince a little bit of ginger. Ginger pairs really well with peaches. Or I've also had peach lavender cobbler, which works well. There's lots of different things you could add to add your own identity to the pie.
My thing lately has been I've got this mutant rhubarb plant that keeps producing through the summer, and I did a peach rhubarb crisp. I'm a little too lazy to make pie. And that came out pretty good. I had to sweeten it up a little bit between the tartness, but it was a pretty good combo.
Oh, I bet.
And I think it's always fun to experiment in different ways. So many peach pies you tend to get, you taste sugar and not peaches. And I think you need to taste the peaches in a good peach pie.
All right. That's a good tip. We've got a comment from Brian on Facebook. Brian writes, I was making jams today. I happen to love peaches and their genetic variant sister, the nectarine. Brian says, I made two batches of blueberry, raspberry, and white nectarine jam. The white nectarine is a wonderful floral flavor that adds a delicious dimension to wild berry jams. Thanks, Brian, for that tip. And let's see. How about Nikiko? Can you talk about preserves, jellies, jams, and preserves with peaches?
Yes, I was fortunate enough to have a mom who loves preserving, so I learned everything I know from her. And there's lots of different ways of preserving. One of my favorite, which definitely comes from her German-American heritage, she does pickled peaches, which are just wild, and I love them.
Wow. Okay, again, you've got a hit in Wisconsin. Put that on a relish tray at a supper club, and I'd eat that for sure.
Exactly.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Kate with us in Duluth. Kate, hi. Kate, are you there?
Hi. Yes. I just put on headphones so I could hear you better.
Great. What's your recipe?
Well, I don't have it in front of you, but our family tradition, I love rhubarb custard pie. And what we did with peaches was kind of a cross between peach cobbler and a custard peach pie. We didn't put the crust on the bottom like you would for a pie. But made a custardy kind of thing and put peaches in and then put a crust type thing on the top. And I my mom always had this cast iron pot. That's what we cooked that in, because we used the pot for making cereal and other stuff. But that cast iron was just great, and then we would make it in the oven.
Great. That sounds wonderful, Kate. You know, both are callers with recipes, and you have mentioned the recipe handing down from their mom. And that's just the family stories about peaches and your family story about peaches. This is something that can really bring the generations together, isn't it, Moss?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I have to hand it to your listeners is the fact that they're willing to cook with and bake with peaches. One of my biggest fears is everyone just thinks they're just going to eat peaches fresh. And I think they're missing out on that whole tradition and legacy.
Nikiko, I'm not really a recipe cook. I like to just see what I have and make something. What's a good way to sub in peaches in just any old recipe?
Oh, that's a great question. Any recipe that calls for mangoes, the substitution is pretty one for one. But I've also found there are some recipes like salsa where you can substitute peaches for tomatoes.
Okay, peaches for tomatoes. Great. Do we have time for one more call? We've got, what's the name, Nita in Hustisford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm loving this show because I love peaches. And I know peaches are really hard to grow in Wisconsin, but we had a tree one time when I was a kid, and my mother canned peaches and threw the pits and peels out in the back by the garden on her compost pile. And, of course, some peach trees would grow. So she let some, she let a couple grow. One survived a couple of winters, and after about the third year, I think it was, it got these three huge peaches on, three or four. And I still remember how good those were, right off the tree. And I think it was the next year, the year after that, the frost killed it.
Oh.
But to get really good peaches, too, we're going through Arkansas, and there was a big stand, huge sign out in front, and it advertised elbow-dripping peaches. And they,
elbow-dripping.
Yep, they were.
Great. Nita, thank you so much for calling. Moss, can you leave us with a pep talk for why we should share your passion for the peach?
I think part of it is understanding where your food comes from and developing a relationship with it. And that's the big thing for me as both a farmer and also someone who wants to be the advocate for all good food, is to acknowledge the people who grow it and realize we're all part of the same community and we work together for that. Because I think the last thing we want are anonymous peaches that are nameless and faceless and probably tasteless.
Moss, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Nikiko, thanks to you as well.
You're so welcome.
That's been a lot of fun. That's David Moss Masumoto and his daughter, Nikiko Masumoto. Their new book is The Perfect Peach. And we've got a recipe again for that peach. Veronica, the word's escaping me now.
Gazpacho.
Wow, blanked on that.
That's on the Central Time Facebook page, so you can check it out there. And coming up, we'll find out about prison guards leaving the Wisconsin State Employees Union. That's coming up next on Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.